On this episode of the Game Developer Podcast, we welcomed guest Zalavir Nelson Jr., the creative director at Strange Scaffold, makers of the recent El Paso Elsewhere. We talked about El Paso Elsewhere, creative inspirations, and the joys and fierce challenges of running a small studio while balancing other projects across media. We also talked about acting and Zalavir's other creative pursuits, which all inform one another. This episode was produced by Jordan Mallory. Thank you so much, and welcome to Zalavir Nelson Jr. from Strange Scaffold. Thank you so much for being here today on the Game Developer Podcast. Would you like to tell us a little bit about what Strange Scaffold is and say hello to our wonderful audience?
Thank you so much for having me. Hi, I'm Zalavir Nelson Jr., the studio head over at Strange Scaffold. Just to cue things up properly, Jordan, can you tell me what is the currently accepted answer in the mainstream as to who killed Kennedy, and like look that up while I'm providing my intro? That'd be great.
Yeah.
Much appreciated. So anyway, Strange Scaffold is a small, remotely distributed game studio whose objective is explicitly to make games better, faster, cheaper, and healthier than the industry assumes is possible. The idea of designing our games is widespread now. Narrative design, audio design, everything is a design, but thinking about how the structures of our businesses and our studios and our collaboration processes also impact the wider landscape of our projects is frankly under discussed. We just say, just start a studio and talk about all the design of a game as if it doesn't emerge from the business case as a direct consequence of the factors that it's exposed to, including late stage capitalism. So discussing those factors, digging deep into making exciting, varied games consistently with a rotating cast of amazing people. I'm here to bring a lot of stuff to life with a lot of good people and uplift the folks around me to survive as much as possible while we do it. So I'm very grateful to be on this podcast and to have you another opportunity to talk about this.
Awesome. Thank you so much. That was a powerful intro, and I really appreciate it. I also realized we are doing this. Is this the one-month anniversary of El Paso Elsewhere, or am I not quite right about that?
We're 2 days early, but we can release it such that it does come at the exact time. So according to Tumblr, JFK was assassinated by Shrek.
Oh,
now
good.
We know.
Yeah, but if he was killed, then who was phone? Sorry, that was a deep cut. I'm sorry. That was a real deep cut. And I'm sorry.
The Game Developer Podcast is the only podcast where you can learn who killed JFK. And it turns out it was Shrek.
It was Shrek all along. Hello, this is Doug. Exactly. Well, tell me a little bit about how you got to this path of being a creative director at this amazing studio with these incredible values and making awesome games with awesome people, because I know that you used to write about games quite a bit, and you still do to some extent, certainly. So I'm kind of like, how did you go from being a journalist to a creative director of a game studio, and how can other people follow in your footsteps if they want to?
Just asking for friends,
you know, all of my friends, because all of my friends are in this position.
The really interesting thing about the journalist to game development path is that you see specific type of person pursue it. There is a type of person that because the stars align in such a way and because of what they've written about and around games, when they move on from games journalism, and it's unfortunate that often it is a when instead of an if, they go into game development. So you have Greg Kosovan, of course, with Supergiant being a very, or is it Kosovan?
I'm not entirely sure. I'm not going to lie. I certainly know who he is of Supergiant fame. We'll fact check that one. Our producer, Jordan, will look that up in the meantime.
After breaking new ground on the case of who killed Kennedy. We will find out how to pronounce the name of one of the most significant creative directors currently working in indie. The idea of like what like, Greg was doing and other people who have followed in that path is that unfortunately what it reflects is this deep drain of talent from the journalism side of things. The people who would be the Roger Eberts of the games world, the people who would be creating the context for thoughtful discussions around what games are and can be, they end up making those games. And by virtue of making those games, they end up defining the discussion, but it also means we get this consistent drain. So my path from journalism into game development was that I was going to leave.
Sure.
I started at the age of 12 pretending to be an adult on the internet. I don't know what it says that I passed as a semi-pro up-and-coming games journalist as a 12 years old, but that's how it started.
Incredible. Yeah.
And from there, by the time I was 17, 18, I had seen a couple generations of my peers burn out, move on, shift to game development or PR or some adjacent field. And I thought I was going to leave. So I was going to make a game before I left, put childish things behind me, and figure out what the rest of my life would look like. And unfortunately, that first game, All Hail the Spider God, showed me, oh, shoot, I really like making games. And the fact that people also enjoyed that project and thought I did have something to say and I had a voice meant that they pulled me right back in. So
yeah,
for people looking to shift over from journalism into game development, the number one thing I'd say is just to do it. Doing something small, doing something with whatever skills you currently have. I used Twine just because I knew HTML and CSS from the journalism world. But whatever your piece of tech or your current skill set, using that to say something in an interactive form, that's kickstarted, for me, an overall career journey of continuing to pursue what do I care about. In games writing, I realized I thought of narrative as a more holistic thing, communicated through several aspects of a game. So I moved into narrative design. And in narrative design, I realized that telling a story is important and powerful, and I care about it. But the quality of that story is, to a degree, second to the idea of the game coming out at all. Sure. Narrative serves... a second fiddle to the idea of destroying as few human lives as possible in the process of making a game and making sure the game comes out at all, because the greatest game story in a game that people never play is a Schrodinger's object. It does and does not exist. So looking into production and management and biz dev and really following the things that satisfied my brain and brought me joy and that put me in positions to protect and uplift people around me resulted in me being in the place I am now, where I write for the new South Park game and I was part of the Magic the Gathering story team this year.
Yes.
And I do all of this wild stuff across games, as well as run a studio, not because I had a cool game idea in my head that I want to be the creative director of, because I actively love the process, the often exhausting trial and crucible of being a studio head and making those hard decisions and trying to take care of as many people for as long as possible.
That makes a lot of sense. And it is actually still very inspiring to hear, to be honest, especially because you're somebody who does it as well as doing other types of work, right? Like you were just saying, you're working in different areas and honestly in different formats as well here as well, which is also super cool. And I do want to ask how that informs what you do at Strange Scaffold. How does your other types of writing, how does writing comics, graphic novels, how does writing Magic the Gathering material, how does it inform all the things that you do in your actual game practice and creating games?
I think what it really opened up my eyes to is how often game developers are intentionally and unintentionally blinkered. The fact that I've now worked on over 80 projects in the past 8 years, from comics to full-on games to tabletop stuff, every single one of those projects provided a data point. It provided collaborators. It meant that I learned something about myself. It meant I learned something about others. And what we do in games and what we consider to be the apex of what you can do in games is take the most talented people you know, the most talented, empathetic, driven people you know, put them in a box for 5 to 8 years, shake it up, and then pour it out. And then tell them to do it again. And that means that's a very specific process. That means that you get very specific, groundbreaking things that otherwise are not possible. But it also means all of those people take someone who worked on the largest, biggest, most critically acclaimed AAA game of the moment, just pick them up out of nowhere and say, okay, now we want you to do a totally different, a game in a totally different genre. Now we want you to collaborate with people on a totally different medium under totally different conditions. If you're wondering why games doesn't seem to be as repeatable as its technical foundations and its inherent conditions seem to suggest, that is partially a longevity problem. We have had a lot of discussion around this year with all of the layoffs, but it's also partially a factor of we don't give people enough experiences, frankly. Compare any director and how much work they do in their first 10 years, both speculative stuff as well as stuff that actually comes out, versus what a single creative director in games tends to get to do in the span of 10 years. And you see pretty quickly, it's immediately obvious why we don't have clearer voices producing more consistently and producing in a way that actively gathers people to care about those voices as well.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I was going to ask about the layoffs piece here as well. Certainly brought it up. Just honestly, there's so many bits of discussion to dig into with that. And I am going to ask you more specifically about El Paso Elsewhere as well. But since it came up, it has just been a bloodbath in the industry. This past year, someone actually rounded up most of the figures of actually our reporting at gamedeveloper.com and, you know, a couple of other sources, a lot of our pieces, and like added it up. And thousands, like to the tune of thousands of jobs lost in not a massive industry. You know, we think of the industry as being quite big, but it's really not compared to so many other things.
Absolutely not.
Just as a human being, I guess your take, and also you're a studio head, you're a creative director. How do you kind of deal with what's going on right now? How do you kind of deal with that uncertainty and that sort of tumult in the industry?
I'll be honest, a lot of what I'm doing is mourning.
Sure.
I have been bringing this up a lot lately in conversation, but Mimimi Games, still don't know if that's the right way to pronounce it, but they have had nothing but overwhelmingly positive Steam reviews on their games. Hundreds of thousands of units sold every single project. But them looking down the road of what it would take to continue to receive investment, keep the studio open, keep their tool set and perspective alive, they called it. They said, this is the time to throw in the towel, because each project nearly breaks us and then we have to go bigger with each one afterwards. And that treadmill means that the only people really making games in that genre are gone, which means that tool set, what happens to it? Do we get games in that genre again? Will the next game that comes out, will players be confused? Because they're like, well, Mimimi Games did it. And it's like, well, Mimimi Games was able to create this polished version of it over time. I talked about this again recently for IO Interactive. Hitman World of Assassination, the apex of what that studio has been building towards, ostensibly for their entire career.
Yeah.
And that's only possible if you get to keep those people making games and making multiple games.
Yeah.
You can see elements of mini ninjas in Hitman World of Assassination, which is beautiful.
Yeah.
And it's something that, even for successful teams, this is something that has been scaring me a lot lately.
Yeah.
Even if you're successful. So we have the layoff equation and how often that robs us of talent and of types of games, and it hurts our players and it hurts our dev community and it hurts our souls, and it's something I mourn for. Yeah. But the second element of this is that if you're successful, you have the second box where if you did No Man's Sky, No Man's Sky is a wonderful success story and comeback and turnaround story.
Yeah.
I'm so glad that it's kept Hello Games alive and that it seems that it will be doing so for some time to come. Unequivocal success. Not going to contradict that at all. The one thing I will say, though, is it is feasible that you joined Hello Games at the start of No Man's Sky and you're still working on No Man's Sky 7 years later.
Right. Yeah.
So the opportunities that are presented by long tails of video games now and what it means to produce a game and engage with an audience long term. If you do get to stick around, the second trap you can get into is being shoved into a box and being kept there if only to keep your studio alive. Because if you knew that there was a lever next to your desk that anytime you pulled it, it got $1 million and you have a team full of people who you're accountable to, you aren't going to stop pulling that money lever. It's not fair to them. So we're just in general in a really complicated situation. And so I spend a lot of time thinking and talking to people and mourning and figuring out what it looks like for me to stick around in this space as well.
Can I ask the obvious follow-up of if you've made any journey down that path yet of thinking of what that looks like for you?
Yeah. Yeah, I certainly have.
Gotcha.
There's a lot of different shapes that that takes.
Sure.
But I think the number one thing that at least emerges to my mind, coming especially off of El Paso elsewhere, is that the only way I get to keep making things in a way that fully enables me to be human and to have a really strong voice alongside other amazing people, hopefully also making sure that their voices have opportunities to be uplifted and seen through those works as well. The way I get to hold that is, frankly, with work.
Sure.
There is a road through which, say, Strange Scaffold had a game that sold 100,000 copies in the first 10 hours. It's just selling like hotcakes. People can't get enough of that game.
Yeah.
If I'm going to keep making the things that I care about and the ways that I care about making them and make more things as opposed to, for example, one perfect, maybe, gem that comes out 8 years from now, that's something I gotta stick to. And that takes a lot of work and that is not organically supported by the institutions and pictures of what success looks like in this industry. 2-3 years from now, people are going to be saying like, hey, if I haven't done anything that was on the scale of El Paso elsewhere or larger, people will be saying, man, you could have been a contender, kid. What's the matter with you? Are you going to do it? Are you going to really make your dreams come true? And it's like, my dream is to tell 100 stories, not one. My dream is to make sure that I can consistently take care of the people around me and that I can eat and that I can bring beautiful, varied things into the world for players and my colleagues' sake alike. That resisting the urge of ego, even to be like, you know what? I will pitch. El Paso Elves were too. It's an open world now. It's an open world now. James, he gets the powers of the werewolf, the vampire, the haunted suit of armor. All of them come to rest within him. It's a Metroidvania and a giant multi-tiered world, and it's going to have a roadmap. It's going to have a roadmap.
Driving, right? Multiple vehicles, right? Yes,
driving
tanks.
Multiple vehicles. Hijack tanks. Vehicles from werewolves. Tanks.
Yes. Tank, werewolf tanks.
3 years of updates. Like, it will take work and humility to not, even for ego's sake, be like, you know what? Gonna do it. Gonna show everyone.
Yep.
All I care about is making things that do the work justice and doing as little human damage as possible in the process and growing and learning as an individual in that process. So as long as I get to do that, if I do something as big as El Paso Elsewhere again, either in terms of critical reception, in terms of scale, great. If I never do again, that's not what the project or what the people around me needed, then for me, that's equally valid. And that is what I pray I have the resilience to actually commit to.
That's a really phenomenal answer. Thank you for that. Clearly, you're a person who thinks quite a bit about your path. And that is honestly really incredible and really cool. And honestly, sometimes even a little bit refreshing. I think
thank
everyone
you. I'm so tired.
Living, no, totally. I fully appreciate that. It's just something that, living in 2023 feels it's robbed so many of us of, is, being able to kind of think about what's next and how to mindfully navigate what's next to some extent, for sure. So I really appreciate that. That's super cool. I do want to hear a little bit more about what was going on in your brain when you were starting to think about El Paso Elsewhere. Our phenomenal freelancer, Sam Makovec, interviewed you about the game, which was one of my favorite pieces actually to edit recently. There were so many really cool inspirations. Like, of course, there's the Max Payne 2. There's also the Die Hard trilogy, which I was delighted to see referenced ever again in my life. Because that's a game I didn't even play, but I read about it in a magazine in like 1996 or whatever year it came out and was just like, that sounds amazing. And never played it, but I have this image in my head of what that game is. That's always like a fun phenomenon to think about. Like games I've never played, but I've seen it or I've heard of it and I have, you know, whatever's kind of going on. 1996, okay, awesome. I was like, I hope I'm like basically ballpark in there. It would be very funny if I was like 10 years off.
That was also one of the coolest things of like, we don't talk enough about games or movies that you didn't play. You had a vibe or I got an idea from them or from the cultural conversation around them.
Yes.
But never experienced them. And they end up playing a distinct part in your creative process anyway. The whole idea of phantom inspirations is something I think about a lot.
Oh, that's amazing because it's a huge part of when I'm making anything in my life. I'm always like, yeah, that's just like X. And then I realize I never played X. I saw screenshots in a player's guide when I was 10. And you know what? It happened in my head and it's beautiful. So it's always kind of fun. But yeah, I'm blathering a little bit here about inspirations and phantom inspirations, but I want to hear about yours, about when you were putting this together, when you're starting to put this together, what were you thinking about other than, of course, Die Hard trilogy? Because I know that was a big one.
One of the biggest ones, and ironically, I'd say El Paso Elsewhere is the result of a lot of cultural osmosis. I think one of the most prominent pieces of its creative process is it's when I had really started to lean into the idea of not judging any piece of media preemptively, or rather discarding its significance because it's quote unquote not my thing.
Sure.
There was a period of time in my life where I didn't listen to country music or metal or mosh or either do, experience, see, or be all of these different things because I assigned a cultural judgment to the people who engaged in that. said arbitrarily, even because I experienced one other thing, then that isn't my thing at all. Wrote off entire genres of games. And by the time El Paso Elsewhere's Genesis came around, and I watched the Constantine movie.
Excellent.
Which is still one of my favorite pieces of supernatural fiction ever. And it's very different than Constantine Hellblazer, but for reasons that make it exceptional in its own right. El Paso Elsewhere is the result of realizing that all types of media and inspirations are valid, and that, in fact, getting over yourself to the point of being able to see it makes you a better creator. So pulling from things I loved as well as things that I didn't love or didn't think that I would love. Sure. One of the most prominent influences on the soundtrack is Sum 41, and it came in at the very end. I had heard a snippet of one Sum 41 song once upon a time.
Excellent.
And there is a previous Little Zoller who would have been like, oh, that's corny. It's like, corny is a word for cowards and and those unwilling to engage properly with what something is laying down. Because
yes.
Sometimes something is mediocre, it can be undercooked, it can be unfulfilled, it can be all sorts of things. But just looking at the idea of a boy band or pop punk and being like, mid, that was El Paso also as a result of saying, no, we're going to honestly engage with things that go very hard. Bram Stoker's Dracula by yes. Francis Ford yes. Coppola? Coppola?
It's a beautiful film.
In fact, beautiful film.
Alyssa McAloon, my boss, our publisher here at Game Developer, and I had like a whole chat about it in Slack the other day of just how amazing that movie is. How incredible. What a nerd Dracula is. And they got it. They got it right because he's a dork and it's beautiful. So these are, I'm glomming onto this. I think it's amazing.
Bram Stoker's Dracula emerges in this game in exactly one asset. It is we have an asset you'll see in a few places across the game where there's this cracked almost, I think the name for it is Teutonic Cross, and it's got little visible veins of blood all throughout its cracks. It is
fantastic.
The idea of this stone thing that is nevertheless filled with human juice and the idea of rampant pillaging of culture and of personal experience in order to bring something to life and that involving things that you'd previously discarded or been like, that doesn't apply. That's what currently gives me hope and life on a given day. And the idea of sincerity and stripping away the layers of artifice and distance that we put in art in order to have it judged as something more worthy of acclaim. That's the journey that I think is the most typical of El Paso Elsewhere. And we've talked in a variety of places about its inspirations, both musical and gameplay and so on and so forth, including amazing websites like gamedeveloper.com. But in general, being incredibly open to anything and everything from no matter where it comes from or who it comes from to produce something that is special in its own right and becomes more than some of its parts. That's I think the journey that El Paso Elsewhere really displays the growth of.
It's fantastic. I want to go two directions with this. I want to go with both the sort of internal direction where you mentioned actually in this interview that I'm referencing, and like, I should put it in the show notes about how you actually like, it wasn't always necessarily a part of the design doc, how hard the cutscenes go. I think that's like a direct quote, like how hard the cutscenes go. And I also want to talk as well about sort of folks' reception to the story and how they didn't expect it to like both go so hard on the very like, you know, the really fun, awesome, pulpy, you know, yes kind of stuff. as well as being very resonant and like hitting folks emotionally. So I want to hear, want to do both of those as a follow-up to this. So I guess first internally, those cutscenes and like sort of going with this idea of like going with it, really engaging with it and actually saying, okay, we can actually take longer with this game because these cutscenes are amazing. This animation aspect is incredible. Let's keep going with that. That's going to make this a stronger game as opposed to being like, no, we have this deadline. We're not doing the cutscenes this way, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, the idea for the cutscenes and how they came about was the idea of a modular cutscene system. We said we do not have the resources to build full animations.
Sure.
And fully animated, lavish cutscenes involving multiple actors, or whatever else. So taking inspiration from The Darkness, which... being a polite young Christian man, once upon a time, I was like, ooh, I won't play The Darkness. That's full of darkness. an older Christian man has the wisdom experience to know, no, The Darkness is rad as heck. Starbreeze is The Darkness. And the idea of this guy sitting in a chair talking to you and how compelling that can be in its own right, saying... scope dodges are not compromises. They are, in fact, limitations that enable creativity. We had the idea of having this bank of animations, these generic animations, these generic scenarios, and repeated quote-unquote sets. I built, quote-unquote, the set for James's hotel room in his mind that the player experiences from multiple angles throughout all those cutscenes. That was the foundation of those cutscenes. And it was aiming for something that would be stylish, but super aggressively efficient and production-minded from the beginning.
Sure.
And when Romero Bonnickhausen, who was the lead programmer of the game and co-designer of it, did his first cutscene within the engine, because I probably should have seen this coming, being the studio head and wearing a bunch of hats on that game, as well as other games and doing biz dev to make sure the game gets funded, all the different stuff, doesn't leave me with a lot of time to make over 30 cutscenes.
Sure. Makes
sense. So yeah. I had started to do some of the tools and do some of the stuff there, and there was some promising results, and Romero wanted to take a swing at it, and I said yes. And what he produced aligned with all of the values of those scope dodges and intentional limitations and creative decisions, but elevated them so much because of his perspective on them. I was like, wow, this is the game. This is what we want to build. So the most direct answer with all of that context to your question of how those cutscenes and the approach towards them evolved over time was we made decisions very early on that as the game's development continued, when we saw how much was possible while retaining those decisions and those values, the person who could bring that to life, which in this case was Romero, was given the space and ability to bring those to life. So was there a temptation at various periods, especially when the game's reception was really building up and taking off, to say, what if we do more elaborate cutscenes? What if the animations get bigger?
Sure.
There is a version of that game that launched, but it's actually not one that is discernibly better.
Sure.
And that is something I think about a lot as a guy who is revealed to be thinking about everything too much all the time. Oh, no.
Sure.
Different, but not better, or more expensive, but not better. Capital B better is something that runs through my head all of the time. And I think El Paso Elsewhere shows a lot of that from its level design. It does not depart from early decisions we made to try to protect team health and to control scope. But it does, in its interpretation of those guidelines, so escalate the vision of the game and what we're saying with it that it ends up becoming a highlight.
Yeah. That's pretty amazing. Could you also codify like exactly what some of those protections were about work life and protecting people's health and keeping scope where it was? Did you have specific rules? Did you actually write down on a document, here are the things we're going to do? Or did you communicate those in some other fashion to the team?
There are some pieces of documentation where we had set in stone limits of here are the weapons in the game. These are our weapons. There are many like it in the third person shooter genre, but these ones are mine. And that's what we're going to stick to.
Sure.
That was an element, but as far as teamwork life balance, I'd say better, faster, cheaper, and healthier ruled a lot of it. And there's a lot of ways that El Paso Elsewhere did not conform to those values at various pieces of development. The last two, 3 months in particular, for the exceptional toll that it took on me, that took on our audio designer and musician, RJ Lake, that it took on our level designers and on Romero and our producer, on everyone at each stage of the game, especially in the last few months, someone was on fire at some point, and there were point periods where multiple people were on fire.
Yeah.
And being very transparent about that as well. Some of the amazing things ended up shipping as a result of that, but also the fact that there's no justification for the fact that it occurred in the first place is, I think, another piece of trying to live out our studio values, because
yeah.
I get approached with a moral authority that I intentionally want to confront and reject. Because I think that is it important that we're talking publicly about wanting to make games better, faster, cheaper, and healthier? Yes. Are there a lot of ways in which we succeed and in which we are able to, in the case of the El Paso Elsewhere development process, like being able to give an animator several months of time off and then have space for them to rejoin the project after they had to take care of, I believe, a loved one who ultimately passed away.
Sure, of course.
Space for them to be on the project, contribute to it, get paid fairly, leave, and then come back and still have a significant role on the project. They ended up animating all of Dracula's animations that got used in those cutscenes. The fact is that Strange Scaffold is special, but we also are constantly forced to balance pragmatism with our compassion. And sometimes that results in scenarios that I'm deeply uncomfortable with.
Sure.
In particular, our audio pipeline, we have hours of audio recordings, over 5 hours of scored music. Pretty much every piece of this chunky old game is individually scored. Plus, we have an original rap album and all of these voice lines. And there was one guy who handled all of that. His name is RJ Lake. And did he kind of set himself on fire with especially some of the decisions he made outside of my control? Yes. But also, he was put into a position to burn and to keep burning for especially the end of our development cycle.
Yeah.
And that was something that I did, that Strange Scaffold did, and that if we don't honestly confront that too, then none of the rest of it matters.
That makes a lot of sense, and that feels like in a classic GameDeveloper.com postmortem would certainly go into that column of what didn't go. You know, there's the what went well and the what didn't go well, certainly. Do you have plans in place for, okay, if some of these things happen next time, what do we do? I mean, I imagine it's difficult to plan for certain things just in terms of if you're not working in the same genre again, if you are working with very different technology or very different systems or very different mechanics, and you have to build out new things, that is one of the main production challenges of game development, as I understand it anyway, as a you know, little teeny baby dev who, you know, mostly makes things on her own.
We're gonna have to talk about that. I didn't realize that.
Oh yeah. Just like little jam games for fun, for funsies, but it's enjoyable. That's teach exciting. Game design too. It's a good time. So my students, my students are fun. They make amazing things on paper, and I always want them to make them for real. So, or a slice of it, you know, like a little slice would be super cool. They ever feel the need to, but yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to get off track there. Kind of that idea of like, is it feasible, not possible, but is it feasible to try to, you know, kind of learn from things that maybe didn't go super well? Is it feasible to say, okay, here's how we can try to plan this out better. Here's how we can try to produce our way through X, Y, and Z when you don't necessarily know what the tech is yet or necessarily know what the genre is yet? This is a big question and you don't have to have a pat answer for it, but I guess I'm wondering this out loud. So I'm going to put it to you.
So something that was, Strange Scaffold is directly emerging from the fact that I do not come from money.
Sure. Yeah.
I don't have a backer or necessarily a publisher for a lot of our work, at least until later in the process, at least.
Sure.
And what that means is for a lot of people, we do what we call the work on top of the work, which is you have typically 3 to 12 months of totally unpaid work on top of anything and everything else that you're doing to then present this to people to have the hope of maybe shipping a video game. And that process of talking to people takes typically 6 to 12 months minimum. Even if like you meet someone day one and they want to sign it, one of the rules of biz dev is from beginning of discussion to signing, you're looking at a 6 month minimum. That is the time it takes. And it's very rare, so rare to manage to actually step outside of that. As a result, El Paso elsewhere had this percolation period of about 2.5 years Romero worked on it part-time. I worked on it part-time. Everybody was basically working on it part-time. And then all at once, the marketing plans came together. We found the level design crew who we would end up shipping the game with. All the pieces came together and it was like, okay, now Jet Engines are on this thing. We have the money in the bank in order to push this out. This is when we shipped El Paso Nightmare. We also dog-fooded our tool set and shipped something with it to present the world present the game to the world and the universe. Have a Halloween game because I've always wanted to make a Halloween game. All that stuff.
Yeah.
What that resulted in, though, was a very lopsided game dev process where everything was pretty chill for 2.5 years. And then the last 12 months, the game was basically on a content side built wholesale.
Sure.
And what that meant was, among other things, QA. QA came in at the end instead of, for example, having involvement at the beginning of the project in the foundations of the technology.
Yeah.
And could we have afforded QA and to do proper multi-stage QA passes on our tech ahead of that time? I sincerely doubt it. But also, it meant that there was concrete additional work for QA and pain that hit the devs throughout. There's ways that affected production. The way that people, when we started implementing all this content, ended up having this cyclical dev process where script impacted levels, which impacted music, which impacted levels, which impacted script, which impacted music, but spread across a surface area of a 7-8 hour video game. 50 levels, dozens of cutscenes, over 40 minutes of fully animated, fully voiced cutscenes. That cyclical nature and structured development also occurring over a tight period of time, that hurt us.
Yeah.
it seems to have not hurt the game too much, thank God, but it did hurt us as people. And it took a lot of intentional work inside of that time to make sure it didn't hurt us more. So if there is one big conclusion we had coming out of that postmortem for El Paso Elsewhere, it was, dang, making big games with little to no cash is giving us opportunities to ship things we honestly couldn't otherwise. At one point, there was a funder, a potential funder, who wanted us to remove slow motion from the game.
Oh, wow.
There are compromises you make when you have people in the room, especially if they don't understand the vision of the project or see the health of your collaborators as also being a tenet to uphold in the dev process. But also, God, that meant that there was ways that we could have concretely saved ourselves, our players, and the game from having these invisible stress lines all throughout. And no excuses to be made for it. We are getting QA involved in our projects much earlier going forward. But there's got to be a way to pay for that, especially as we continue to uphold these principles and look for partners who align with our values. And thank God we consistently manage to keep finding them. But what that means is that money's got to come from somewhere. And that's additional pressure that ultimately falls on me.
That's the treadmill you spoke about earlier, or the danger of it, certainly.
One of the best quotes I've ever heard on this was communicated by a friend of mine who's been running a studio for a while. I don't know if he'd want to be named, so I'll leave the name out. But what he said is, your processes never go backwards. And that is the pain of running a studio long term, which is you can never miss payday. You always learn more. You have to uphold the responsibility of learning more. It isn't the chaos of, new company. Oh, new company again. We're always figuring things out. When you've been doing things longer, El Paso Elsewhere, if we make the same mistakes, we are not just financially responsible for them, we're ethically responsible for them.
Yeah.
That's the difference between a mistake and a decision. So really reckoning with El Paso Elsewhere too, all sorts of ways we could make that better, but also the sobriety of, man, if/when we make El Paso Elsewhere too, that game has to have its process be better because we've already done it once. Any game we've done afterwards, we're doing Life Eater right now, a urban fantasy kidnapping sim. That game is immediately reflecting. We had a full-time producer on El Paso Elsewhere, or full in our studio's terms.
Sure.
We had a dedicated producer on the project late. Life Eater was 5 weeks into development when we had, at the time of the postmortem, 7 weeks. And it was like, okay, well, lead producer on El Paso Elsewhere, you're not the lead producer on Life Eater. Because one of the things that we found was having a production voice much earlier on a project is so massively better in terms of what we can do there. And my attention is split, so someone's got to maintain that Notion board. And the idea that my project management and my project configuration and assembling the team and all that, that's not the same as production. Sure. Production can and does mean something else, and there is an additional burden of care there that having a dedicated producer on a Strange Scaffold project earlier is going to result in higher benefits. And that's more money that has to be made to pay for that person. So,
of course.
That's Life Eater's got a dedicated producer now, and we're continuing to iterate for what it means for us on what it means to have a healthy, expansive dev cycle. And I'm sorry for rambling and for sharing documentation and stuff.
Not at all. This is fantastic. I'm actually a giant production nerd, I think of myself, like I think of editor-in-chief as being a producer of sorts. So it's a very, I was going to ask you what you use, and you said Notion, which is cool. I was like, oh, are you guys like Asana? You're like Trello? Like, are you Jira? Like, yeah, I'm a big production nerd. I will just let you know. And thankfully, this podcast is such that I can be one, which makes me happy.
Production and process is like the start of this conversation. I think it's where you set up the structures that result in the product. It is where you set the structures that result in taking care of your players and taking care of your team. It is where you set up the game. So I've always super valued it, but having dedicated producers that are empowered much earlier on a project is relatively new to the studio. We've had part-time producers or people who cover multiple aspects of a game, but usually when a game is looking at its, what I'd say, most intensive dev period, that's when the dedicated producer comes in, and now we're bringing that on much earlier so that maybe that intensive period looks less intensive. Just always trying to learn, and it's one of the things that is kind of hard to communicate while also bigging up your studio and picking up more funding is there's a lot of things that we very visibly do quote-unquote right, or at least exceptionally, and we try to be very transparent about that, but that none of that transparency means anything if we aren't also taking lessons very publicly as well.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And that does always sound like a good thing to have a producer on as early as possible.
Yep.
Seems like I've heard that a couple of times, certainly. I was even going to ask you if you had done some of the production work early on there. Gotcha. Yeah.
But notably, it was a very specific type of production work, right?
Sure. Sure. Of course.
All the intersections of production work and how often games in particular lumps in biz dev and management and production, and production in the sense of, I'd say, operational product management, as well as asset tracking and collaboration, like external management, like all of those just get lumped up in this giant ball we call production.
Yeah.
And I did and do still fulfill that on a lot of Shrink Scaffold projects, but it's this invisible weight that is another thing I think we haven't fully reckoned with as an industry, where maybe the entire studio isn't crunching, but the number of studio founders that I see who are tanking the damage of all of the things we see as just another task, a miscellaneous production or a production thing. Production is often where miscellaneous gets shoved.
Yeah.
That's another thing I think about a lot, and we're trying and honestly growing to recognize that there are the ways I was trying to relieve pressure on my producers by taking more weight myself harmed those producers in some cases, and in several cases, certainly harmed me. That's a learning process and a growing one. And it's one I'm a little bit frustrated I didn't fully get through my head before now.
Sure.
But also before now, I didn't necessarily have the resources to act upon that either.
Sure. That does make a certain kind of sense. Yeah, definitely. I have a fun, hopefully an all-encompassing question for you. It doesn't involve a coin-sized man. I'm sorry, but I do want to ask if there's sort of, if you like to think of connective tissue among all the games, among all the Shrink Scaffold games. If there is, I don't mean a connected cinematic universe by any means, but if there are bits of connective tissue, or do you really like to think of things as like, this is its own kind of unique thing. We put all our energy towards this particular project at any given time versus like there are threads kind of flowing among them.
I would say that the connective tissue for a Shrink Scaffold game is honestly my voice.
It's pretty.
That is one specific place where I own the advantages and disadvantages of doing a quote unquote auteur studio. We're trying to do that in a more ethical and uplifty way than that's typically been handled.
Sure.
But the idea that someone plays an Airport for Aliens currently run by dogs and then plays El Paso elsewhere and they feel the same things, they see this same spirit expressed in a different genre, different team, different setup, everything, finding ways to tie that voice together is really the heart of the studio. I tell people about this as far as our strategy all the time. I'm not trying to sell people one game. I'm trying to sell them five. And yes, the fact that we actually have seen that come about, Sunshine Shuffle did fine for itself, but it was kind of quiet sales-wise. And then after El Paso Elsewhere, a Poker Night at the Inventory meets Animal Crossing with a hard-boiled detective story. The fact that that game is getting a sales bump.
Yep.
From Max Payne's spiritual successor is, I think, a testament to the fact that we're succeeding. We're releasing a catalog of stuff that the same way you follow your favorite director or musician, when you see a Strange Scaffold game, you know that it's made with certain values and it is gonna express something wild. So even if you aren't typically a player of that genre, you're going to get some of that Buck Wild, Zolivier Nelson Jr. sticking in a character named Chad Shakespeare into every single video game magic. It's one of my favorite things. The fact that I get to look back at this set of very disparate work and am able to call out all the people who worked on it, as well as say, yeah, That is another thing I did. It feels dang good, man. And part of the reason I am bemoaning the current state of industry is all of the conditions exist for more people to have that.
Sure. Yeah.
If you try to think of individual, even creative directors who tend to have a lion's share of the visibility for a game dev process, let alone a level designer or audio person or a producer. I've had the chance to now meet several producers and learn their philosophies and how those end up expressing themselves in the games. And you never hear about that stuff. But anyway, the fact that you can maybe count on one or two hands people who you're able to trace a thread through their work.
Yeah.
Man, that doesn't speak well to games at all. That's a big old warning sign on a medium level, because what it says, even from the most exploitative business view possible, is the next time you make a game in X franchise, you have no idea what it's going to look like, how it's going to feel, or how it's going to sell. And that is a deeply dangerous space in which to be regularly spending $200 million and risking entire sets of studios on a single release for.
Yeah. Thinking back on some of the most inflated budgets we've heard about in certain studios and just like, yeah, oh my God. I do want to ask a literal voice question as well.
Yeah.
Since, you know, of course, talking about your voice and it coming through here. You did the voice for James. That's correct, right? I didn't just conjure that up out of nowhere. And that would be really embarrassing for me if I did. So I should ask for confirmation here, right?
Nope, I sure did. That's me.
Okay, that would have been really weird if I had just thought like, oh yeah, of course, you did the voice. What was that like? Was that something you had always thought, okay, I'm gonna do the voice for this character? Like, did you conceive of it that way? Or was that something that kind of came about and was like, no, this is awesome, we're gonna go with this?
I wanted to play this character from the very beginning. When I was writing, when the very original version of El Paso Elsewhere became a thing, when it was a comic book script that actually got sent around to some big publishers and stuff. That was really cool.
Sweet.
From the beginning, though, like, the character was supposed to be, in terms of physical appearance and in terms of, hey, who might play him in a film adaptation? It was supposed to point giant glaring neon signs towards me. I wanted a protagonist I could fully inhabit and do justice to, most importantly, not just have the auteur thing of, oh, ho, ho, I will also star in my own work and it's going to make me look super cool. But what is a protagonist in a story I can really do justice?
Yeah.
And what are the processes you go through in order to do the work and give it dignity while not becoming an egomaniac? It's something that was a constant interrogation throughout the dev process. And to be honest, it was one of the most cathartic pieces when the game finally released, because this character and this story and this world and this role I wanted to play as an actor, but knew I would never get the chance to play. I don't think I've ever talked about this in an interview, but the big reason for El Paso Elsewhere was I was thinking of how I would approach a Max Payne. And I realized in a burst of frustration and some anger, wouldn't be able to play the character, wouldn't be able to have that level of autonomy on a license that size, even if I got my hands on it. And furthermore, there's no way you're going to get in that point in the first place, buddy. What the hell are you thinking? So taking all of that frustration, being like, fuck it, I'm James Savage now. It legally distinct, legally distinct. OC James Savage. We're gonna build a new universe, new set of things, because I'm not gonna be stopped from playing this type of character. I'm not gonna be stopped from having this type of impact on the world. I'm not gonna be stopped in terms of finding a way for a team to come together and make something that is greater than my original vision and character. A lot of people go to support a performance, a vision, and El Paso Elsewhere is certainly evidence of it. So going into the process of making the game and over time having to strip away artifice, starting as more of a parody of Max Payne to something that is distinctly its own thing, to something that is so raw and vulnerable as to be able to reach people and maybe do something new that its inspiration couldn't quite even hit. That was so hard and ended up dredging up a lot of personal material on top of the exhaustion of like making a lot of the game. I did a TikTok about this idea of time bubbles, where everything, regardless of how much time you want it to take or how much it should take, it takes its own time. And being a performer for this character was its own time bubble that had to coexist alongside the other time bubbles. And I feel like it barely got the time that it needed to for me to inhabit that character and to fully inhabit that role on the project. That was immense. And realizing that the key to bringing him to life when we started, especially the recording sessions, was read a line. It's a well-written line, but is it the most honest, sincere depiction of this idea? Is it what James would say? Does it bear your / James Savage's soul? That ended up being the North Star for the performance aspect of the game. And I think it's something you can really feel. I hope it is anyway.
Oh, absolutely. From what I've experienced of it, it is very striking and incredible. Absolutely incredible. And again, also seeing a lot of, you know, just seeing comments as well, seeing Steam reviews, seeing what folks have said about it, Rick. That's something that seems to come right out immediately at the top of a lot of things. So that's amazing. It's really, really cool. Have you always been an actor? I guess I should also ask that little backup. If you have been acting, if you've been performing, if this is something that kind of comes naturally to you, that made you kind of want to do this, or if this is something you were like taking it out for this.
I've always done a little bit of acting and performance. Sure. A lot of the way I think about writing is sure. performance based. But yeah, I knew especially from the jump, just walking around as a guy who exists, the chances of me ever getting the chance to play this role as a black performer, sure. to be frank, digging into all of the elements of this balance. I love performance. I've been a performer for a long time. I knew I could do this, but I also knew the chances of me getting the opportunity to bring this to life and do it justice was next to zero. So like a lot of things in my career, when I wanted to jump out of games journalism or leave, I was like, okay, then if no one's just going to let me write a game, so I'm just going to do it myself. For comics, comics was part of what entirely altered the way I see narrative and storytelling. Because when I was younger, I thought that comics were things that were immature, and I read books with no pictures in them, actually. Thank you. And getting past that, I went like, "Oh God, I was a stupid baby person." For writing comics, I've had a chance to write a comic this year. That's going to be in A Profound Waste of Time, which is so exciting.
Oh, that's amazing. Excellent.
Yeah, that journal does incredible things for games literature, and getting the chance to make their first ever comic. The thing that led to that was me saying, well, every opportunity I've had to date came from just doing the work. So I'm going to do the work again. And I tested out the waters and I did a bunch of research and brought a lot of cool things to life with a lot of artists, learned a lot in the process, among them that somehow the working conditions and production process of comics is even more broken than video games. Oh my gosh. If you see a comic artist, give them ask them if it's okay to give them a hug, because dear Lord, do they need it? The compensation and the safety for their work in contrast to what they produce is so, so deeply separated. But yeah, I've always been a performer, knew I wouldn't get the chance unless I did the work, and I'm doing the work. And now I'm getting offers for roles and offers to audition for roles. And it's like, yes!
Hell yes. That is extremely inspiring.
My secret plan to sneak into game performance by spending 3.5 years crafting a game performance, and actually, it's not a... I didn't sneak in... The funny part of like your brain goes like, aha, I'm doing a heist. And it's like, no, you're just doing the work.
You already built the house. Like, it's like the thing, like you're doing the heist. You built the house that you're now heisting. Like you made it.
There's a Key and Peele sketch about robbing a bank by becoming a teller and working there for 40 years and then getting retirement, and they keep paying you even after you leave. And it's like, dude, you just described a job. That's... That's how I've gotten to every job. And if anyone wants James Savage to write again, but under a different name for your indie game about depression or something, here I am. Happy to help.
Honestly, that's awesome. It's like going way beyond shoot your shot. It is build the gun, then shoot your shot. And now you also have the gun and the shot. Like, it's amazing.
Why don't more people build guns and bullets?
Right?
It's the number one way to becoming a game dev success.
I gotta write that down. We gotta quote that one. That's
become a gunsmith.
Become a gunsmith. There it is.
I guarantee if you look in Sid Meier's garage, it is filled with light machine guns and antique warheads he has built himself from iron that he did smelt from the ground and did trade from Mesopotamia.
Yeah, there's a lot of cannons. just so many like half exploded cannons in there, and it's, you know, you had to start somewhere. Oh my God. I could talk to you all day, honestly. And I kind of want to, but I do have to, we do have to end soon, but I always want to give, please. I know we were just talking about building your gun before shooting your shot, but you don't even have to right now. You can just excuse me. You can just sort of, you know, give out any websites or socials that you want people to listen to. You can plug anything that you'd like. This is your time right here to plug things, not pitch, but plug. Different P word there. Yeah.
Well, you can follow Strange Scaffold's work at Strange Scaffold on multiple social media platforms. We have games on PC, Switch, and Xbox. And fingers crossed, I'll have some news to announce soon about additional platforms in the near future. If you like games made weird, with heart, with quality, and that respect your time and invite you on your next adventure after giving you something you would never experience otherwise, check out a Strange Scaffold game. I'm also, among other things, the co-lead on the revival of Defender's Quest, if you remember that deep cut. I'm
awesome.
I wrote that. I am was the co-lead on that project. Defender's Quest 2, Mists of Ruin, coming soon. Check that out. Last piece, if you want to follow me and my work and my rambles about sometimes optimistic, sometimes terrified about the state of video games and how we can make video games gooder without destroying ourselves in the process, I'm at Rit Nelson, pretty much all places, WRIT Nelson. Thank you again so much for having me on this wonderful podcast. I have loved seeing where game developer has gone over the past few years, especially with the rebrand and it stepping into what truly feels like its own. So having the opportunity to chat once again here about all sorts of things, including the fact that people should definitely hire me to do more performance, because God, I love it, even though every time I step into what the team came to call the sweat box caused me existential distress near the end of the El Paso Elsewhere development cycle. It's fine. I go to GDC every year. I know what it's like to experience, go someplace that causes you existential distress, because it also makes you happy. Put me back in the booth. Tag me in, coach.
There's a lot of both, for sure. Oh, that's fantastic. I can't thank you enough. This has been awesome and honestly very inspiring. You know, of course, we're writing a lot of news every day, and some of it has been not the easiest to break, certainly. And it's been really inspiring, honestly, to chat with you and hear your honest assessment of how things have gone and how you've made something really beautiful and really unique and really cool. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Oh, El Paso Elsewhere. Should I say that it's on Steam and, and Itch and Xbox? El Paso Elsewhere is good. A bunch of people think it's good. If you like liking things that other people think is good, El Paso Elsewhere exists. And if you don't like liking things that other people think is good, not everybody thinks it's good yet. So you can be cool.
See, there's two kinds of people in this world, you know?
And both of them can buy El Paso Elsewhere.
Honestly, awesome. Thank you so much. This has been the Game Developer Podcast, produced by Jordan Mallory. Jordan, thank you too. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Jordan.
Thank you all, and have a great rest of your day.